reaction in the press, Bank of America no longer intends to implement a debit usage fee. "We're facing bigger economic challenges than we're used to," said David Darnell, co-chief operating officer. "In an effort to boost our revenues, we thought we would try to implement a fee on debit card purchases. We expected some backlash, but not as much as we got. As a result, we will not be moving forward with any plans to charge any additional fees on debit card purchases for any of our customers. Further, we apologize for being short-sighted. We've certainly learned an important lesson about just how valuable our customers are and how much influence they can have over our financial standing." Even though their decision would still have been completely counter to customer interests, simply being honest about it would have done more to engender trust. Bank of America actually would have enhanced their reputation had they simply told the truth. The trust we have for an organization is built the same way as the trust we have for individuals. We need to know what to expect so we can better navigate our social bonds and know with whom we can make ourselves vulnerable and with whom we can express our weaknesses or turn our backs. It's not about winning or losing. All we want to know is if we can feel safe in a foxhole with you. Like the Marine who wanted to take responsibility for his actions only after he got caught, there is a disturbing trend in modern business to do the same. When a company gets caught with its hand in the cookie jar, do the leaders have a meeting to discuss how to mitigate or avoid punishment, or do they discuss the need to do the right thing based on a higher moral code, a code of ethics and integrity? Unlike the leaders of Ralph Lauren, the leaders of Bank of America chose to spin information to give the appearance of concern for their customers, when as plain as day, they were acting out of more concern for themselves. Say your boss tells you that the company you work for has suddenly lost its biggest account, and that as a result, you and everybody else in your department are going to have to take a pay cut, perhaps even a furlough as the company tries to regroup. "Sure, it's going to be tough for a while," your boss says, "but if you agree to stay on, you'll be compensated once things improve." Whom would you more likely believe with this information? An executive from Bank of America or an executive from the Ralph Lauren Corporation? As the Zen Buddhist saying goes, how you do anything is how you do everything. Chapter 20. Leadership Lesson 4. Friends Matter. To win or to serve. At some point in the early 1990s, Newt Gingrich, Republican representative from Georgia's 6th Congressional District, frustrated that the Democratic Party had control of the House for decades, decided it was time to give the Republicans a shot at power and take the majority. The trouble was, he was tinkering with a system that wasn't really broken. The two parties actually worked quite well together. Though the Democrats had the majority in Congress, unlike today, the primary goal wasn't to brag about who had control. It was to brag about who got things done. Knowing that whoever had the majority still needed the other party, the Democrats didn't take full credit every time something was accomplished. Efforts were made behind the scenes to allow both parties to claim victories and appeal to their respective bases. Election after election, the Democrats kept the majority by default, not because they were better per se. When control was not the primary goal, things got accomplished and both parties were able to get their needs met by working together. It was also common practice at the time for members of Congress, once elected, to move their families to Washington, D.C., returning to their home district offices as often as the congressional schedule permitted. In Washington, they existed in a small world in which their families went to the same churches and schools, regardless of their party affiliations. Democrats and Republicans would argue, debate, and criticize each other in committee by day, and then attend the same school events, backyard barbecues, and cocktail parties at night. Despite their differences, relationships formed, as did the ability to trust and cooperate with each other. Charles Gibson, former news anchor and fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, recounts how George McGovern, Democratic senator from South Dakota, and Bob Dole, Republican senator from Kansas, would both take to the floor of the Senate and rail against each other's policies, then be seen behaving as the best of friends later the same day. In another example, Tip O'Neill, the outspoken Democratic Speaker of the House, had regular meetings with Republican leader Bob Michael. They worked together. As Reagan's tax cuts were being debated in the early 1980s, Gibson recalls that O'Neill told Congress The president has no concern, no regard, no care for the little man in the country. In response, President Reagan accused O'Neill of sheer demagoguery. Later, when the president called O'Neill to smooth the waters, O'Neill is said to have replied, "Old buddy, that's politics. After 6 o'clock we can be friends, but before 6, it's politics." These days, the politics seem to last all day and all night, leaving little time for the friendships. And so it was. Members of opposite parties bridged the gap by forging friendships that gave them perspective. They felt a sense of common purpose. Though divisions had always existed in Washington, for most of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Congress functioned. Democrats and Republicans had, for the most part, figured out how to cooperate, which, as our biology and anthropology help us understand, happens most effectively when we physically work together and get to know each other. Gingrich, a man who seemed more obsessed with winning than anything else, would set Congress on a new course, however. Cooperation was out. The new goal was control. The strategy he chose was to tear apart the existing system. To disrupt the status quo, he worked to portray a system so corrupt that only a complete overhaul could save it. And in 1994, he succeeded. The Republican Party took control of the House with Gingrich at the helm as Speaker. And the hope for any cooperation between parties was over. Once in charge, Gingrich promoted a whole range of changes that completely altered the way things were done in Washington. And it started with more fundraising. One of the changes included the idea that House members should spend the majority of their time in their home districts, not in the Capitol. In the 1980s, nearly two-thirds of members of Congress lived in Washington, D.C. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find more than a handful. Instead, members fly into Washington for a short work week, arriving at Congress on Tuesday and returning to their home states on Thursday evening. The result marks a major shift in relations between Democrats and Republicans. Spending most of the week away from where the work is in order to fundraise, members of the two parties now even have less opportunity to talk to each other, and they certainly don't socialize together as routinely as previous generations of legislators. And with that, there is little opportunity to develop trust. Of course, there were many forces at play that led to the deeply divided Congress we have today, and Gingrich's ascendancy was just one of them. Redistricting and highly politicized media programming contribute to the polarization, as has over-reliance on the internet. Why work face-to-face in Washington when you can send an email from anywhere? Members of Congress have gone from sharing power to hoarding it. With no single guiding vision or purpose, we've moved from governing as a selfless pursuit to governing for selfish gain. Just as business moved from serving the customer to serving the shareholder, Congress went from a culture of cooperation to a battle of wills. All leaders, in order to truly lead, need to walk the halls and spend time with the people they serve. Eyeball leadership, as the Marines call it. The same goes for our elected officials. Yet that's not what's happening. Today, members of Congress say they're spending more time in their home districts in order to better serve their constituents. But they don't actually serve them by doing this. There's little evidence that when back in their home states, our elected representatives are visiting factories or working with citizens to better understand their needs, except perhaps during an election season. What they seem to be doing more of when they return home is fundraising to help ensure their re-election. When we are disconnected from the people with whom we work, we spend more time focused on our own needs than the needs of the people for whom we're supposed to be responsible. In a PowerPoint presentation shown to newly elected Democratic members of Congress, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, recommends a model schedule while members are in Washington. 4 hours spent making fundraising calls, 1 to 2 hours for constituent visits, 2 hours for work on the floor or in committee, 1 hour for strategic outreach, breakfast, meet and greets, and the press, and 1 hour for recharge time. In fact, Tom Perriello, who served in Congress for one term, told the Huffington Post that the 4 hours allocated to fundraising may even be lowballing the figure so as not to scare the new members too much. Regardless of whether or not the members uphold the model schedule, it is just another example of the pressure to make the numbers, win elections, and stay in power instead of building relationships, finding common ground, and making progress for the common welfare. Like the CEO of a public company who cares more about winning and numbers than they do about the people who are doing the actual work, so too have our elected officials got their priorities backward. It is not a surprise that the relationships in Congress today are in a shambles. Hostilities between the parties are at an all-time high. Veteran congressmen recount anecdotally that in the past, about 80% of the debate about a new bill would happen behind closed doors in committee, and 20% on the floor for the camera. These days, party leadership takes debates to the floor before attempting to get consensus in committee first. Olympia Snowe, the Republican senator from Maine who served for 33 years, decided in 2012 not to stand for re-election, even though she was the easy favorite to win. In a statement given by Snowe and reported by one of her hometown papers, she explained, "I have had to consider how productive an additional term would be. Unfortunately, I do not realistically expect the partisanship of recent years in the Senate to change over the short term. So at this stage of my tenure in public service, I have concluded that I am not prepared to commit myself to an additional 6 years in the Senate." Snowe is just one of a growing number of people who, after devoting their lives to public service, are now leaving due to frustration with the caustic environment. If the good guys are leaving, that means that the future of our government is in the hands of the ones who either benefit from the current system or have the stomach to endure the excessive fundraising, increasing short-sightedness, and growing culture of self before service. The result of such an aggressive atmosphere in our government is, as we would expect, a lack of trust and progress. A Gallup poll in January 2013 showed that the U.S. Congress had an approval rating among Americans of only 14%. That's lower than the approval rating of used car salesmen or even Genghis Khan, the 12th century Mongolian emperor infamous for his slaughter of as many as 40 million people, most of them innocent civilians. It is not surprising that 3/4 of Americans, the poll shows, believe that the way politics works in Washington is harmful to the country. And based on all we know about the conditions necessary for trust, cooperation, and progress to exist, they'd be right. If, as social animals, we are most productive when we trust and cooperate, then a lack of trust and cooperation means less will get done. Congress is now considered largely ineffective as a governing body. At the time this book was written, the 112th Congress, the Congress that served from January 3, 2011 until January 3, 2013, was considered the most polarized Congress in history. It passed fewer laws than any time since the 1940s, only 220. The Congress before that passed 383 bills into law, and the Congress before that passed 460. If we accept that passing laws is a legitimate metric of cooperation, even the Congress that previously held the record of least productive, the 104th Congress from 1995 to 1996, was more cooperative with the 333 bills they passed into law, over 100 more than the 112th. The disregard for the human element of governing shows a steady downward trend in the ability of Congress to get anything done, and the effects of this are dramatic. According to political observers, the public largely blames the inability of members of Congress to work together for the economic crisis of 2008. A polarized Congress has been blamed for a lack of progress on the deficit, on reforming Social Security, and on dealing with climate change, among a host of other things. Some current members blame the system, or the speed with which news is able to spread in a wired world, for their struggles and low approval ratings. However, they ignore the fact that they are the system, and the internet doesn't do them harm, it simply reports on the harm they do. The problem is not politics, money, or the media. They are symptoms of the problem. The reason our Congress is as ineffective as it is just a matter of biology. The members of Congress don't spend any time together. If they don't get to know each other and the people they represent, the flow of the social chemicals is limited, and the drive to raise money and win elections makes dopamine their primary incentive. The environment in which our legislators now work makes it difficult for them to trust each other or work together for the benefit of anyone but themselves. Enemies fight, friends cooperate. The members of Congress from the House Agriculture Committee were in Romania as part of a tour to learn more about trade policy and meet some of their European counterparts. It was only by chance that Bob Goodlatte, the long-serving Republican congressman from Virginia, and Stephanie Herseth Sandlin, a junior Democratic congresswoman from South Dakota, found themselves the only two people from the delegation with nothing to do after a day of meetings. And so, they decided to do some souvenir shopping together. Despite serving on the same committee, the two representatives served different parties, and by the unwritten rules of Congress, that meant they were adversaries. Until that day, their relationship could have been described as cordial at best. There is something about getting together out of context that makes us more open to getting to know someone. Whether we're bonding with colleagues with whom we play on the company softball team, out to lunch or on a business trip with someone we don't know well, when the responsibilities of our jobs are not forcing us to work together, when our competing interests are put aside for a while, we seem to be quite open to seeing others as people rather than co-workers or competitors. This may be one of the reasons peace talks so often happen in serene environments where the two warring parties can go for a walk together. And that's exactly what happened with Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte. Without the weight of politics or their respective parties breathing down their necks, the two of them went exploring together. The Democrat and the Republican became Steph and Bob. And as it turned out, they really hit it off. Though they disagreed on many things at work, they had a lot in common as regular people. As we all know, it is the things we have in common with people that attract us to each other and are the basis of friendship. By the modern standard, what happened between the two members of Congress with opposing views is almost unheard of. Given how little time members spend in Washington, there is simply less opportunity to get together socially with people they like, let alone to try to form relationships with people they're expected to resent. But on this day in Romania, the seeds of friendship would be planted and later grow into something that would serve both representatives for years to come. With the foundation laid, Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte continued to get together for meals in Washington with no other reason than they enjoyed each other's company. They started to see and treat each other as human beings instead of adversaries. Like any two warring parties that eventually make peace, the two representatives learned that what they had in common was the basis of the trust they needed to talk about the things about which they disagreed. "We paid attention to each other," Herseth Sandlin recounted. "We listened to each other, and we compromised on bills we might not have otherwise." Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin still voted in opposition to each other more often than not. They didn't always see eye to eye on legislation, but they didn't need to. It was because of mutual respect and friendship that occasions arose when they agreed to do the right thing, even if it meant one of them would have to vote against the party line, which, unlike in a parliamentary system, is technically what we elect our representatives to do in America. Representative Goodlatte even voted for an amendment sponsored by Herseth Sandlin, much to the disappointment of GOP leadership, she said. That rarely happens these days. It's worth noting that when Olympia Snowe voted to allow more debate on the subject of health care reform, her own party lambasted her publicly and threatened to pull her funding, just because she voted to continue to talk about it. Cooperation doesn't mean agreement. It means working together to advance the greater good, to serve those who rely on our protection, not to rack up wins to serve the party or ourselves. What the two members of Congress built was a genuine appreciation and respect for each other. What they formed was nothing more than what we in the world outside of politics would call a friendship. That such a relationship should be considered extraordinary enough to serve as fodder for a book is somewhat disturbing. Getting to know the people with whom we work every day seems like it should be the normal way of doing things. A few years before Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin's experiment, a few forward-thinking members of Congress tried to do the same thing. Recognizing the caustic relationship-lacking environment that consumes Washington politics, they called for a series of retreats with the aim of encouraging greater civility in Congress. The first one was held in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Dr. William Urey, world-renowned peace negotiator and co-author of the book Getting to Yes, was there. He recalls several representatives telling him the same thing about the quality of the relationships in Congress. They had spent more time with members of the other party during those 3 days than they had in their entire careers, Yuri recounted. Sadly, the retreats were soon canceled due to lack of interest. It turns out that friendship and trust can't be built over 3 days. It takes a regular commitment of, no big surprise here, time and energy. If there is conflict, without knowing each other, it's very hard to make peace, says Yuri. And Yuri knows a thing or two about peace. Founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project, he is widely seen as one of the leading authorities on negotiating. He is often called upon to help negotiate peace deals among adversaries in various parts of the world. We need them to understand each other, he says, to humanize each other, and to listen to each other. Few would argue with Yuri's sentiments. We know that for there to be peace between Israel and Palestine, the leaders must meet. They must talk. We know that for there to be peace between India and Pakistan, they must be willing to come to the table and to talk and to listen. And when the parties refuse to talk, refuse to listen, refuse to even meet, then the odds are high that the conflict will only continue. How can our Congress have the credibility to tell the world how to make peace when they seem incapable of demonstrating how it's done? Herseth Sandlin and Goodlatte are a model of what could be. If the system will not allow for one party to socialize with the other party, hope lies with the individual senators and representatives who have the courage to lead. If they are driven by the desire to serve their constituents and the country, then investing time and energy simply to get to know each other is essential. If, however, they are driven primarily by the desire to win elections and keep their party in power, then the current system is working just fine. For them, not for anyone else. Without retreats or formal engagements, all that is required is for a few progress-minded members in one party to personally reach out to a few progress-minded members of the other party to meet for a drink or a bite to eat with no agenda. If they care about the American people, it is anthropologically necessary for them to get together for no other reason than to get to know each other. Like any relationship, some will get along and some won't. But in time, cooperation will happen. Chapter 21. Leadership Lesson 5. Lead the people, not the numbers. Neutron Jack. 10 years after economist Milton Friedman wrote about the social responsibility of business, to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game, his words became the rallying cry of a new movement that would consume Wall Street and corporate America. The primacy of the customer was replaced with that of the shareholder, the true owner of the company, a self-serving definition that is often refuted by legal experts. The thinking was that by focusing on shareholder value, companies would build wealth, create jobs, and fuel the economy. Everybody wins. But that's not what happened. By everybody, they meant only a few. When we understand the history of the theory of shareholder value, the results aren't surprising. The 1940s saw the rise of managerialism, a system that defined U.S. corporations as having a broad social purpose. For most of the 20th century, the directors of large public corporations saw themselves as trustees and stewards, charged with steering institutions in directions that served the public as they provided stable, lifelong jobs. It was a system that worked fairly well until the challenges of the 1970s. In January 1973, the U.S. stock market reached past a peak before entering a 2-year period of almost steady decline fueled by a number of events. It started with President Richard Nixon's decision to abandon the gold standard, which led to inflation, among other challenges, followed by the Arab oil embargo in 1973, during which time the price of oil quadrupled. Add the impact of Watergate and the war in Vietnam, and the U.S. economy stagnated. The market wouldn't hit bottom until December 1974, 4 months after Nixon's resignation, when the Dow Jones reached a low of 577, a 45% drop from its high less than 2 years earlier. It was the beginning of a new era in which companies' share price had little to do with its overall performance. As humans do when facing uncertainty and confusion, people went looking for answers. corporate directors and stakeholders were eager to protect their interests and return to growth, and economists sought a simple metric for measuring corporate performance. They found it in a little-known theory called shareholder value. Though Milton Friedman first proposed the general idea, it was a pair of academics, William Meckling of the University of Rochester and Michael Jensen of the Harvard Business School, who spread it with a piece they published in the Journal of Financial Economics in 1976. It was the answer everyone was looking for, a formula that could solve the problems of a corporate America fed up with stagnation and falling profits. In 2012, Professor Lynn Stout of Cornell Law School wrote a definitive work on the subject, The Shareholder Value Myth, in which she points out that shareholder value was instantly appealing to two influential groups, activist corporate raiders and company CEOs, the very groups that would stand to benefit most from it. And so it took hold. Carl Icahn and other corporate raiders began trolling for financially stricken companies to swallow, and there were a lot of them in those days. They typically went looking for companies whose stock was undervalued, bought up shares, and then forced the board to cut expenses, usually through layoffs or by selling parts of the company. At the same time, the pay of corporate executives became directly linked to stock performance in the form of options and bonuses, thereby ensuring that executives were financially incentivized to put their priorities ahead of both customers and employees. During the boom years of the 1980s and 1990s, titans like Jack Welch, then CEO of General Electric, and Roberto Goizetta, who ran Coca-Cola, were pioneers in building companies to maximize shareholder value. And for a time, it seemed to work. That is, for shareholders. Both companies made their shareholders and their executives a lot of money. Back in the managerialist period, CEOs were typically paid in fat salaries and small bonuses, while in this new period, they would be paid according to stock price. The strategy gave rise to the first generation of billionaire CEOs who neither founded the company nor took it public. Goizetta, in fact, holds the distinction of being the first American business executive to become a billionaire on the basis of stock holdings in a company he didn't found or take public. The second was Microsoft's former CEO, Steve Ballmer. By the end of the 1980s, shareholder value had become a managing principle at GE, where Welch had been in charge since 1981. Every year, Welch would fire the bottom 10% of his GE managers, those whose divisions contributed the least to the company's share price, while rewarding the top 20% with stock options. This rank-and-yank system was in place for most of Welch's tenure at GE, and helped earn him the derogatory nickname Neutron Jack. Welch did indeed succeed at building a powerful company that made lots of money for its shareholders, and many companies still consider the Welch way the route to higher profits. While he was running things, GE sales increased from $26.8 billion to $130 billion. The company's market cap rose 30 times, making it the most valuable company in the world by the time of his departure. There's no question what Welch achieved was remarkable, and that few others have achieved anything near it. However, if we compare GE's performance to the performance of the S&P 500 over the same time period, it makes the accomplishment seem less impressive. GE's trajectory matched the trajectory of the market for the time that Welch was in power. It's like celebrating the rise of an oil company's stock as the price of oil increases. A rising tide lifts all ships. This is a point not lost on Welch's successor, Jeffrey Immelt, who took over when Welch left in 2001, right before things got really rough. Anybody could run a business in the 1990s, Immelt told the Financial Times in 2009. A dog could have run a business. It is also worth pointing out that during this period, half of GE's profits came not from its core industrial business, but from its financial arm, GE Capital. If we judge Welch by the kind of leadership that succeeds by focusing on profit before people, then he retains his title as Wall Street's hero. A man brilliant at developing systems to maximize short-term value. But great companies and great leaders are the ones able to succeed beyond any one leader and manage through hard times. What if we judge a leader not on what they do when they are holding the torch, but on what happens after they pass it on? On that metric, Welch doesn't fare as well. A leader's legacy is only as strong as the foundation they leave behind that allows others to continue to advance the organization in their name. Legacy is not the memory of better times when the old leader was there. That's not legacy. That's nostalgia. The founding fathers of the United States have a strong legacy because the United States was built to last long beyond their lifetime. GE was built to maximize the opportunity of the day, a day when the numbers mattered more than the people. It was not an opportunity built to last, and so it didn't. Jim Collins and Jerry Porras make the case in their book Built to Last, that when the genius at the top leaves, they take all their expertise and genius with them. In contrast, when a leader has the humility to distribute power across the organization, the strength of the company becomes less dependent on one person and is thus better able to survive. In this model, instead of trying to command and control everything, the leaders devote all their energy to training, building, and protecting their people, to managing the circle of safety, so that the people can command and control any situation themselves. That's the best way to protect the legacy of the leader and extend the success of the company for many years after the leader departs. According to a study conducted by Dr. Natalia Lorenkova, who studies management and leadership at Wayne State University, teams led by a directive leader initially outperform those led by an empowering leader. However, despite lower early performance, teams led by an empowering leader experience higher performance improvement over time because of higher levels of team learning, coordination, empowerment, and mental model development. In other words, all of the benefits of higher performing teams are direct results of feeling safe among their own and believing that their leaders have their well-being at heart. Any other model is simply a gamble that the next genius will be as good as the one who left, irrespective of how strong the rest of the company could be. This gamble on the next guy theory adds an unbalanced importance and uncomfortably high risk to succession planning. If the new leader can't command and control as effectively as their predecessor did, it is doubtful many inside the organization will put themselves at risk to advance the leader's vision. They'll be too busy trying to protect themselves from each other. At some companies, layoffs continue to be such a normal occurrence in the fourth and first quarters, when the company is trying to make their numbers, that some employees take extreme measures to protect themselves. A source at a large investment bank, privy to this information, told me that like clockwork, during the period before the announcement of annual earnings, the number of internal complaints filed for harassment, discrimination, and whistleblowing protection suspiciously go up. There is no obvious reason why there would be a season for complaints. One would expect an even distribution throughout the year, and there is no reason why harassment, discrimination, and whistleblowing protection should all happen at the same time. It turns out that the number of internal complaints goes up right at the time when some companies start looking at their end-of-year numbers and making preparations for layoffs to meet their projections. It seems that at the end of the year, employees start filing complaints in an attempt to protect their bonuses and, at the same time, their jobs. It's not a culture that inspires people to give their blood, sweat, and tears to the company, its leaders, or each other. It's a culture of watching your own back. And so they do. Welch and others, through the 1980s, pioneered using people as an expendable resource to the benefit of investors. Since then, it has become increasingly more common for companies to use layoffs to beef up their bottom line. It is considered an acceptable business practice today to lay off people, often ending their careers, simply to balance the books for the quarter or the year. If careers are to be ended, it should be for negligence or incompetence, or at least as a last resort to save the company. But in our 21st century version of capitalism, the expectation that we are working in meritocracies seems false. In many cases, it doesn't matter how hard we've worked. If the company falls a little short, people will have to be laid off. No hard feelings. It's just business. Can you imagine getting rid of one of your children because you made less money than you expected last year? Imagine how your kids would feel if that were the plan. Well, that's how it is in too many companies today. By the mid-1990s, the transformation was complete. Shareholder primacy was now the mantra of corporate America. And with it came a whole host of new problems. thanks to cultures with unbalanced levels of dopamine-driving behavior and too much cortisol flowing, empathy had become limited and self-interest a dominant motivation. And with that, we started to see an increase in stock manipulation, massive pay inequality, and more than a fair share of accounting fraud, all of which continue to this day. It seems reasonable that the leaders of companies should work hard to protect the interests of the company's owners. However, a strong case can be made that shareholders don't actually own the companies. In the view of Professor Stout, Friedman, the hero of modern capitalist economics, was simply wrong. There is no legal standing to the idea that shareholders are the true owners of corporations. They simply own shares, which are abstract representations. In legalese, corporations own themselves. And given that shareholders are not the true owners of corporations, corporations have no legal requirement to maximize share price, as many have claimed. Professor Stout takes this thinking even further, to argue that maximizing shareholder value has failed. Sure, it's fattened the pocket of the corporate elite, but in virtually every other way, it has been bad for business and bad for the companies themselves. Employees are forced to work in atmospheres where short-term performance is valued above all else, and where the well-being of people is almost always put second, the consequences of which are empirically bad for the company. And contrary to its claim, shareholder value maximization has done little or nothing for dispersed shareholders. According to research conducted by Roger Martin, the dean of the Rotman School of Management, shareholders who invested in the S&P 500 in the years prior to 1976 enjoyed real compound average annual returns of 7.5%. After 1976, the average dropped to 6.5%, he says, and has been even lower than that since 2000. There's a growing body of evidence that the companies that are the most successful at maximizing shareholder value over time are those that aim toward goals other than maximizing shareholder value, Justin Fox and Jay Lorsch wrote in the July-August 2012 issue of the Harvard Business Review. Employees and customers often know more about and have more long-term commitment to a company than shareholders do. Consider the case of British Petroleum. As examples go, I'll concede it is an extreme one, but it highlights what happens when people ignore the impact of their behavior on others. Boom and bust. On the night of April 20th, 2010, the shareholders' value exploded into the news, quite literally. This was the day an explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil rig killed 11 workers and caused 5 million barrels of sticky, black crude oil to start spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, creating an environmental and financial disaster that would take far longer to fix than the 5 months it took to cap the well. How could a catastrophe of such epic proportions happen? Accidents are a normal outcome of human carelessness or mistakes, and we all make mistakes. But that so many would later call the accident inevitable means this was more than an isolated error. As it turns out, BP had a long practice of cutting corners in safety in order to stay on schedule and on budget. After an explosion in 2005 at BP's Texas City refinery killed 15, the company reluctantly admitted it had ignored safety procedures to keep costs down. During the 3 years prior to the Deepwater explosion, BP had racked up 760 egregious, willful safety violations, according to OSHA records. Over the same period, Sunoco and ConocoPhillips had each racked up 8, while Exxon had only 1 comparable citation. A survey of workers in the Deepwater, all of them whom either worked for BP or Transocean, the rig's owner, taken just weeks before the blast, showed there was an overall feeling among the workers that the Deepwater rig was entirely unsafe. The data was there in front of the owners, but they wouldn't listen. Blinded by their own dopamine-driven focus, they were simply too short-sighted to heed the warnings. By the spring of 2005, the Deepwater Horizon project was already more than 6 weeks behind schedule and $58 million over budget. The pressure on the company was intense. Each additional day's delay was costing another $1 million. Eventually, BP would plead guilty to 11 felony counts, in addition to which it faced more than 1 million claims filed by aggrieved parties. BP has already paid $713 million in lost tax revenues to Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, and Texas. The company estimates the cost of the overall settlements at $7.8 billion, on top of the $17.6 billion fine imposed for environmental violations. Based on the fines alone, BP could have been 12 years behind schedule and still have lost less money than it has over the oil spill. As Professor Stout points out, BP would have done much better for its shareholders even if it had delayed well development for as long as a year in order to follow proper safety measures. Shares of BP were $59.88 in the week preceding the spill. On June 21st, as the spill entered its third month, shares were $27.02. Nearly 3 years later, in February 2013, the shares had still not recovered, trading at about $40 a share. The shareholder, invested in multiple companies and industries, not only lost money if they had any holdings in BP, but the impact of BP's carelessness was felt throughout the industry. A ban on drilling in the Gulf, combined with the longer process for obtaining offshore oil and natural gas permits, were estimated to cost the United States more than $24 billion in lost oil and natural gas investment, according to industry officials. The same report, commissioned by the American petroleum industry, estimated that the United States lost 72,000 jobs in 2010 and 90,000 jobs in 2011 as a result of the spill. Add to that, if any shareholder, as part of their well-balanced portfolios, owned any property in the Gulf region, or equity in companies that operated in any businesses affected by tourism, including restaurants, construction, shipping, and a host of other industries, their finances were harmed as well. If providing the shareholder the value they expected was BP's chief goal, it's a wonder why the loudest voices against BP, the ones demanding greater controls, weren't the oil companies themselves. The rise of shareholder primacy and an over-reliance on external dopamine incentives to drive that primacy has put executives in the habit of thinking for the short term, a trend that is not surprising if you consider that the average tenure of a corporate CEO is 5 years. Consider GE. Like many of the powerful financial companies of the 1980s and 1990s, it was not built for hard times. Nor was Enron, nor was WorldCom, nor was Tyco. These companies had something else in common as well. They all had hero CEOs who maximized shareholder value for the short term and managed the lives of human beings like they were numbers on a spreadsheet. But numbers never save anyone in hard times. People do. Even Welch himself would eventually call the focus on shareholder value the dumbest idea in the world, insisting to this day that he always saw shareholder value as an outcome and not a strategy. The emphasis businesses put on shareholder value was misplaced, he said. Your main constituencies are your employees, your customers, and your products, he goes on to say. A few days after Welch spoke these words in 2009, 8 years after his retirement, GE lost its AAA credit rating with Standard & Poor's, toppling it from its perch as one of the nation's most creditworthy companies. The perverse interpretation of shareholder first has created cultures in which barely a single person working in any public company, large or small, feels protected by their leaders. Too many CEOs seem to skip the hard work of actually leading their employees. With an eye on short-term results, executives can't truly inspire workers. Wall Street's priorities maintain unreasonable power over executives, and, by extension, entire company cultures. People in these companies fear they could lose their job if the stock takes a tumble. And to our primitive human brain, that feeling initiates instincts of survival. When fight or flight is the name of the game, and no broad circle of safety exists, then kill or get fired is the best strategy. Feeling uncertain and insecure, our ability to create relationships and trust in a scalable or meaningful way is near impossible. And when that happens, our work suffers, the culture suffers, and the whole organization suffers. But not so fast. It is also important to note that we, the shareholders, are also just as susceptible to the lure of profits over people. During the dot-com bubble, we were the ones investing based on tips from our friends. Research was something largely ignored. With dopamine driving our need for instant wealth, we lunged at opportunities without taking the time to check all the facts. Worse, fearing we would miss out, we seemed to blindly trust information regardless of the source. We cannot get away with simply pointing a finger at people like Welch or BP, or the theory of shareholder value when we behaved just as irresponsibly to make a quick buck. Leadership by the people. The performance of a company is closely tied to the personality and values of the person at the top, and the personality and values of the person at the top set the tone of the culture. A man who has penned 5 books about leadership and put his own face on the cover of all of them, Welch, it's fair to say, liked his celebrity, and the culture of his company followed. In Jack Welch's GE, people were pitted against each other. They were driven to do whatever they could do to make themselves look good. A priority was put on the thrills of dopamine achievement, capped off with a selfish love of serotonin-fueled status. Being number one was all that mattered. Ooey-gooey oxytocin be damned. James Senegal is different. He ran his company completely the opposite of how Jack Welch ran his. Most people don't even know who Senegal is. He doesn't put his own face on things, and he would rather his people get the credit instead of him. The co-founder of Costco, Senegal ran the company from 1983 until his retirement in January 2012. Unlike Welch, Senegal believed in a balanced culture, one in which looking after people was the priority. Senegal knew that if the company treated their employees like family, their employees would reciprocate with trust and loyalty. He rejected the widely held notion that to succeed in retail, particularly in the warehouse sector, companies need to keep salaries low and employee benefits at a minimum. His people-first attitude was the foundation of a culture that allows the social chemicals to operate as they were intended, and this, in turn, allows trust and cooperation to develop. Workers are praised for finding solutions and better ways of doing things. They look out for each other rather than competing against each other. Both Senegal and his successor, Craig Jelinek, have taken heat from more than a few Wall Street analysts for this approach. Back in 2005, when Senegal refused to pass on a greater percentage of healthcare costs to employees, Emmy Kozloff, an analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein & Company, faulted him for being too benevolent, a description I suspect Senegal quietly appreciated. Ignoring less than selfless counsel from those outside the company is one of the factors that make CEOs like Senegal leaders and not followers. It should come as no surprise at this point that the empathy leaders like Senegal have for their employees is, in fact, good for business. If you had invested in GE and Costco in January of 1986, just after Costco went public and only a few years into Welch's tenure as CEO of GE, at the time this book was written in October 2013, you would have made about 600% on your investment in GE, about the same as the S&P average. In the same period, you would have made nearly 1,200% investing in Costco. Though GE's highs reached levels of 1,600% on the initial investment, it was a roller coaster to get there, and there was no guarantee you would have timed the sale just right before the decline. However, in Costco, you would have enjoyed a comparatively steady, even-keeled ride, even through the rough waters of a difficult economy. This further confirms Dr. Lauren Kova's research that distributing power, though not as good in the short term, is much better over time. Good leadership is like exercise. We do not see any improvement to our bodies with day-to-day comparisons. In fact, if we only compare the way our bodies look on a given day to how they looked the previous day, we would think our efforts have been wasted. It's only when we compare pictures of ourselves over a period of weeks or months that we can see a stark difference. The impact of leadership is also best judged over time. Unlike Welch, Senegal, by cultivating a strong circle of safety, built his company for bad times as well as good ones. He also built it to survive him, which is why Costco's profits continue to grow even through Senegal's retirement. Certainly, Costco saw its growth slow during hard economic times. Its share price suffered through the last half of 2008, and not every store has been a success. But a look at the big picture reveals a stability not found in companies whose leadership is ruled by the thrills of dopamine. Performance can and does boost morale in the short term, but as is the case with all dopamine rewards, that feeling doesn't last. In contrast, when a balance of serotonin and oxytocin is maintained, and the focus is put on morale first, performance will follow and the strong feelings will last. When people feel good about working at the company, they will work harder for the company, in that order. Costco has succeeded because it recognizes employees are like family, not in spite of the fact. That Costco is an amazing place to work actually drives the company's performance. In other words, what's good for employees really is good for Costco shareholders. Today, Costco is the second largest retailer in the country and the seventh largest in the world, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Wall Street is in the business of making money between now and next Tuesday, Senegal once said. We're in the business of building an organization, an institution that we hope will be here 50 years from now. Even through the recession that started in 2008, the company posted profits of more than $1 billion a year, while continuing to have the highest wages in the retail business and providing company-subsidized health insurance to nearly 90% of its employees. Costco pays its workers an average of about $20 an hour, while the federal minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. By comparison, Walmart's average wage for full-time employees in the U.S. is roughly $13 an hour, and the company provides health care insurance for only about half of its workers. And that's not all. While Walmart and other major retailers have rallied behind an effort to defeat an increase in the federal minimum wage, Costco executives have been vocal in their support of it. Instead of minimizing wages, said Jelinek in a 2013 statement supporting an increase, we know it's a lot more profitable in the long term to minimize employee turnover and maximize employee productivity, commitment, and loyalty. The leaders of Costco believe every company should extend the circle of safety to every employee, including the ones at the lowest levels of the organization. In the fall of 2009, the slowdown of the economy began to hit the retail sector hard, and Costco, like its competitors, began to feel the pressure. In April 2009, the company reported a 27% decline in sales. The industry began to retract, and some chains announced layoffs. What did Senegal do? He approved a $1.50 an hour wage increase spread out over 3 years. According to Costco CFO Richard Galanti, Senegal was steadfast in his insistence that workers needed extra help during a recession, not the opposite. This economy is bad, Senegal is reported to have told Galanti. We should be figuring out how to give them more, not less. That's not to say Costco has never had layoffs. It has. In early 2010, 160 employees out of 450 in a brand new store in East Harlem, New York, received pink slips after the store's sales were disappointing. The difference between Costco and companies like Welch's GE is that Costco uses layoffs as a last resort, whereas the GEs of the world use them as routine strategy. As a result of this attitude, turnover at Costco is extraordinarily low, less than 10% for hourly employees. Whereas people go to work for Walmart because they want a job, people go to work at Costco because they want a future and a sense of belonging to a team. The company also prefers to promote its longtime employees to executive positions rather than hire from outside, and almost never goes looking for business school graduates for managers. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, more than two-thirds of Costco's warehouse managers started as cashiers and the like. This is one of the protections the leaders of Costco have embraced to ensure that the circle of safety they have spent so long building stays intact, that those who benefit from it will stick around and keep it strong. This is the value of loyalty. Customers will never love a company until the employees love it first. Only when a critical mass of employees feel like their leaders are working to help defend them from dangers outside, can the company then invite customers into the circle too. It's usually the people at the edges, the infantry, so to speak, who are the most vulnerable to the external dangers. They are also the ones who tend to have more contact with the clients and customers. If they feel protected, then they will do all they can to serve the customers without fear of repercussions from the company's leaders. It is a given that profit is a goal of any business, but to suggest that it is the primary responsibility of a business is misguided. It is the leaders of the companies that see profit as fuel for their cultures that will outlast their dopamine-addicted, cortisol-soaked competitors. The Abyss. Part 7. A Society of Addicts. Chapter 22. At the center of all our problems is us. Enlightenment. Case 1. Mrs. Blank was confined on the 7th of May at 5 o'clock p.m. after a natural labor of 6 hours. At 12 o'clock at night, on the 9th, 31 hours after confinement, she was taken with severe chill, previous to which she was as comfortable as women usually are under the circumstances. She died on the 10th. This was a typical case of puerperal fever, an epidemic that was sweeping across Europe and America in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Though fatalities resulting from complications during childbirth were not uncommon in those days, sometimes affecting as many as 6% to 12% of childbirths, this was much worse. At the height of the epidemic, puerperal fever was responsible for killing as many as 70 to 80% of women who gave birth in some hospitals. The symptoms, which included fever and abdominal pain, would strike only days after a mother gave birth. Death often followed shortly after. So devastating were the effects of the disease that it was called the Black Death of childbed. Needless to say, the intensity and pervasiveness of puerperal fever sent shockwaves through the medical community and caused a considerable amount of anxiety among the doctors of the day, who were attempting to convince people that their hospital care was far superior to the care people relied on at home. The good news was that this was the age of enlightenment in Europe and America, a period that saw the rise of an intellectual class determined to reform society by replacing tradition and faith with science and rational analysis. Also known as the Age of Reason, it was a time when empirical data was the name of the game and expertise was the currency. Enlightened physicians of the day drew from complex theories based on their own experiences and studies to explain the puerperal fever epidemic and offer sometimes equally complex ideas for how to prevent its spread. But for all their good intentions, for all their science and data, for all the complex models they developed, the doctors failed to consider one significant factor in the spread of the puerperal fever: themselves. In an earnest attempt to advance their thinking and figure out a solution to this scourge, it was common for intellectually driven surgeons to perform autopsies in the morning, study the victims for clues, then attend to patients in the afternoon. The idea of germs, however, was not yet well understood, and the surgeons frequently did not properly wash their hands or sterilize their instruments. It was not until 1843 that an American physician in Boston, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, father of Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., proposed in an essay in the New England Quarterly Journal of Medicine and Surgery that it was the doctors themselves who were responsible for the spread of the disease. He insisted that doctors had a moral obligation to purify their instruments and burn the clothing they wore when administering care to infected women. Though it originally went largely unnoticed, Dr. Holmes's essay did stir controversy among some of his peers. He came under attack from many of those he accused of doing accidental harm. "Doctors are not the cause," said one critic. "They are gentlemen." But the body of evidence that Holmes had collected was hard to dispute. The more doctors performed autopsies on women killed by the deadly disease, the more women were infected. Some of the doctors performing the autopsies even contracted the disease themselves. Still, it wasn't until 12 years after his original essay was published that the rest of the medical community accepted responsibility and began adequate sterilization practices. Only after the men who claimed to offer the solution accepted the way they conducted their business was part of the problem did puerperal fever all but disappear. The corollary between the spread of puerperal fever and the dangerous disease affecting our business culture today is disturbingly close. We live in the new age of enlightenment. Only now, our men of science are men of business and economics, who rely on metrics, drives for efficiency, lean, Six Sigma, calculations of returns on investment, and empirical data as the preferred means to guide decisions. And with all our numbers and systems, we require a greater reliance on managers to manage them. And like our inability to see the forest for the trees, sometimes we can't see beyond the system or the resource to be managed to see the people doing all the work. The bigger the scale, the more abstract things become. And the more abstract things become, the more we rely on numbers to keep track of it all. It makes perfect sense. The fact that the conditions that existed before each of our stock market crashes, except for the oil crisis in the 1970s, were nearly identical, cannot be mere coincidence. Like Dr. Holmes, we need to look at ourselves for answers. Leadership is about taking responsibility for lives and not numbers. Managers look after our numbers and our results, and leaders look after us. All managers of metrics have an opportunity to become leaders of people. Just as every doctor in our country learned the importance of sterilizing their instruments, so too must every leader of every organization do the little things necessary to protect their people. But first, they have to admit that they are the root of the problem. A very modern addiction. It was the most incredible feeling. It worked like magic. Any sense of despair or discomfort, any unease or insecurity, any fears or anxieties, even feelings of intimidation caused by another person or situation, were gone. He felt like he was in a state repaired, as he called it. He felt that he could do anything. He felt like he was the person he wanted to be. This is how John felt when he drank. Dutch courage, some call it. The boost of confidence we can get from a couple of drinks. If a guy is at a bar with a couple of friends, and he makes eye contact with someone he finds attractive on the other side of the room, all he needs to do is walk over and introduce himself. But that can be intimidating to a lot of men. A drink or two is all it takes to calm the nerves and find the courage to walk across the room. Now multiply the anxiety and the courage needed to face the world by an exponential amount, and we can start to understand the power and importance alcohol plays in an alcoholic's life. Thanks to the dopamine released by the alcohol, the feelings of struggle, intimidation, fear, anxiety, and paranoia go away when they drink. This is one of the reasons taking control of alcoholism is so difficult. All the problems an alcoholic may face, stress at work, stress in a relationship, stress with finances, and any feelings of inadequacy, all get worse and more difficult to confront when sober. Others have a drink and go home, explained one alcoholic. I had to drink to leave home. For a huge number of those affected by the disease of alcoholism, their drinking began when they were teenagers. It is a time in our lives when almost all of us have to deal with feelings of insecurity and inadequacy. It is a time when we transition from needing the approval of our parents to needing the approval of our peers, a need that lasts a lifetime. Social awareness and our desire to belong or fit in are part of our anthropological growth. We all want to feel like we are a welcome and valuable part of a group. Concern for what others think about us is a natural part of our becoming social, and it is necessary for our survival as a species that lives in groups, even if it's confounding for our parents during those teenage years. Combined with our budding sexuality and changing bodies, the social anxiety, sense of confusion, and self-doubt during this time can be, for many adolescents, overwhelming. This is the reason for supportive parents, teachers, friends, and community. This is, in part, the value of the family dinner, team sports, hobbies, and extracurricular activities. It is the strong support network we build during this fragile period that teaches us that we need others to help us cope and survive. But some teenagers accidentally discover that the magical forces of alcohol can be a much quicker way to find strength and confidence. Left unchecked, alcohol can become a substitute for relying on other people for support during periods of self-doubt. This is important because the way we learn to deal with our struggles and anxieties during adolescence is likely to become the way we deal with these challenges for the rest of our adult lives. Using alcohol or cigarettes or binge eating to put our minds at rest is highly effective. These activities can all be done alone without the help or support of anyone around us. They all work immediately or close to it. In other words, it doesn't require much work to find the calm or relief we get when we drink or smoke. It happens basically at the same time we drink or smoke. The pleasure we derive from alcohol or nicotine or food all comes from dopamine. Dopamine is the chemical that is released when we accomplish something or find something we're looking for. It is one of our internal incentives, designed to encourage us to look for food, finish building a shelter, and generally make progress as a species. It is designed to keep us engaging in behaviors that are supposed to be in the interest of our survival and prosperity. Mother Nature could not have imagined or prepared us for a time when chemicals like nicotine and alcohol would be available to short-circuit our reward systems. Dopamine was built for a time when food was not readily available. Our bodies weren't built for a food-whenever-we-want-it world. Binging, gambling, drinking, and smoking are all ostensibly dopamine addictions. They are easy ways to get the shot of dopamine we love and crave. And when we are unable to keep our desire for dopamine bursts in check, they become addictions. We reach a point where a chemical designed to help keep us alive actually rewards us for engaging in behaviors that can harm us. This is exactly what has been happening in our corporate cultures, where incentive programs create environments ripe for a new kind of dopamine-driven addiction. We're addicted to performance. Have a dopamine addiction. You earned it. Our Paleolithic ancestors prepared for the hunt, excited about what the day might bring. Their ability to imagine what their goal looks like, and the rewards it may confer on them, gives them their first shot of dopamine as they set off. One of the hunters finds some clues to indicate that a gazelle has been in the area. There's another shot of dopamine to encourage them to keep going. One spots a gazelle in the distance, then a bigger shot of dopamine as they track the animal for the next few hours. Finally, they get a rush of adrenaline and excitement. At the point of the kill, dopamine surges through their bodies, giving them a huge sense of accomplishment. They congratulate one another and thank their trusted leader, serotonin now coursing through everyone's veins. They slap and hug one another, feeling intense bonds of brotherhood with those who have been out in the muck with them for these few days. The oxytocin reinforces their bond. The fearless hunters bring the food back to the tribe, who shower them with praise and respect. The serotonin flows again. The rest of the tribe feels looked after and grateful for the risks the hunters took for them, and everyone feels good and enjoys a tasty meal together. Like our prehistoric predecessors seeking food, in the business world today, we receive a burst of dopamine with each marker we hit on the way toward our end goal. Unfortunately, unlike our ancestors, we are working within environments in which the reward systems are unbalanced. Dopamine-releasing incentives predominate. Our incentive structures are almost entirely based on hitting goals and getting financial rewards for doing so. What's more, they are usually set up to reward individual performance on achieving short-term goals, a month, quarter, or year. They can even end up pitting co-workers against each other, accidentally promoting behaviors that undermine the progress of the group as a whole. One of my favorite examples comes from the heady days of America Online, AOL. The company would routinely send out CDs in an attempt to get people to sign up for its product. One group within the company, responsible for acquisitions, was given financial incentives for hitting subscription goals. And so, all tactics were designed to do just that, sign people up. There were offers of 100 free hours in the first month, which became 250 free hours, then even 700 hours. I remember when the offer got to 1,000 free hours, as long as they were used in the first 45 days, which left 1.7 hours of sleep per night for anyone who could take advantage of the promotion. It worked. Whatever tactics the acquisition group members developed were designed to do one thing and one thing only: maximize their bonus. The problem was, there was another group responsible for retention. They had to find ways to get all the people who had canceled their subscriptions to come back. By creating a system in which each group was preoccupied with its own metrics, without concern for anyone else's, or even what would serve the company best, the leaders of AOL had effectively incentivized their people to find ways to cost the company more money. For the most part, the incentive structures we offer inside our companies do not reward us for cooperating, sharing information, or reaching across the company to offer or ask for help.